President Trump and the Democrats versus Mitch McConnell on whether those relief payments are going to get a lot bigger. Not a matchup I expected, but hey, it's still 2020, so why not? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Washington, D.C., I'm Kimberly Adams in for Kai Rizdal. It's Tuesday, the 29th of December. Good to have you with us. Long-awaited stimulus relief is in sight for many Americans, but the suspense continues. Today, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell blocked an effort by Democrats to raise the amount of the next round of stimulus checks to $2,000. That leaves the payments, for now, at about $600 per person. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman took a look at how we can expect this round of relief payments, however much they end up being, to move through the economy compared to the last time.
In the spring, as the pandemic spread and the economy was shut down to stop it, stimulus checks went out. $1,200 for an individual, $2,400 for a couple. And, says University of Chicago economist Constantine Yanalis, within the first 3 months, most of the money stayed in the bank.
People spent about a third of their checks.
Yanalis says there are two reasons a lot of people didn't spend all the money right away. First, those who still had their jobs and income didn't need the money to pay their bills. And with pandemic shutdowns, it was hard to shop and travel the money away. Meanwhile, Americans who had lost jobs and income tried to stash away whatever stimulus money they could.
People had expectations that the crisis would be very long and their income might be disrupted for a long period of time.
This time around, Yanalis thinks that even with vaccination underway, there's still so much economic uncertainty that most people will try to save some of the money again. But that may be harder with this second round of stimulus checks. 9 months into the pandemic, millions of Americans are still out of work and unemployment benefits are dwindling. John Lear is an economist at Morning Consult.
Lower and middle income Americans who really have very little savings have gradually had to eat into their savings because they don't have the income to cover their expenses each month.
They're likely to spend their stimulus right away on necessities, food, rent, utility bills, and car payments. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
The relief package also includes several types of aid for small businesses, including a new paycheck protection program. And it's different from the last round in a few ways. For example, this time business owners can claim tax deductions for payroll and other expenses their PPP money covered. Small business advocates welcome the change, but as Marketplace's Justin Ho reports, owners still face a lot of uncertainty when it comes to their tax bills.
Before the new relief package was signed into law, New York City cocktail bar owner Ashwin Deshmukh just wasn't sure when he should apply for forgiveness on his PPP loan and how that would impact his tax bill.
Should we even wait to do the forgiveness application until next year? It's just a waiting game.
The new round of relief will let business owners deduct expenses that their PPP money paid for. But the IRS hasn't yet provided guidance on how exactly the new relief package will affect a business owner's overall tax liability.
This is like a whole new ballgame for us. So we're kind of just grasping.
Nicole Davis owns the Georgia-based firm Butler Davis Tax and Accounting. She says she normally fields a lot of tax questions at this time of year. But this year, small business owners are especially anxious about their taxes, their outstanding debt, whether they should apply for the new round of PPP money.
There are clients that are reaching out to us on a weekly basis, trying to get advice and guidance on how they should navigate like their next week of cash flow.
And business owners need clarity soon, says Karen Kerrigan, president of the Small Business and Entrepreneurship Council.
Because they just don't know how much capital they need to hold on to versus what they can continue to put into their business to compete and grow.
Kerrigan says either way, small businesses that receive aid should be keeping good records. The IRS has indicated it could ramp up audits in 2021. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
The labor force has changed so much since the pandemic started. Millions of people have been unemployed, furloughed, or lost income in the last 9 months. Hundreds of thousands of people left the workforce entirely. We want to hear what you've been going through. Send us a note about your economic journey through the pandemic at marketplace.org. On Wall Street today, not so thrilled with McConnell blocking those bigger relief payments. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. been spending a lot of time on this latest COVID relief package because it's going to affect many different parts of this economy, like public transit. There's $14 billion in aid for U.S. transit agencies in the legislation. Ridership is down pretty drastically in many places since the start of the pandemic. Now, the MTA in New York and BART system in San Francisco will get a hefty share of the new funds, but the money will also go to transportation agencies throughout the country. And as Marketplace's Andy Euler reports, many are worried this is just a Band-Aid.
The $14 billion is less than half of what the industry was lobbying for, but
first, we just need to stop the bleeding.
Ben Fried is with the think tank Transit Center. He says with people across the country still working from home and some afraid of catching COVID on the bus, this relief will stop the bleeding for a few months.
You know, the best estimates indicate that there will be a budget crunch for transit agencies going into 2021 and probably lasting through 2022, so this won't be the last aid package they need.
He says this money will allow transportation agencies to avoid doomsday scenarios of thousands of layoffs and drastic service cuts. Yona Freemark at the Urban Institute says those cuts would have affected many of the essential workers who continue to use public transit to get to their jobs.
People who work in grocery stores, people who work in retail, people who work at hospitals continue to need public transportation and actually continue to ride it.
Freemark says it's the white-collar, higher-income communities that have seen the largest reduction in ridership. Paul Skoutelis is president of the trade group American Public Transportation Association. He was relieved they got anything and is already planning on lobbying for more, but the goal isn't stopgap packages.
We're looking for a major, really landmark piece of legislation to be working with the new administration and with the new Congress come next month.
He hopes that involves a dedicated federal funding stream that doesn't need to be renewed, especially because ridership isn't expected to get back to normal for years. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Even if you're not commuting, our colleagues over at the Marketplace Morning Report still bring you the latest on all of this. Listen tomorrow and check them out on air or in our podcast feed. A lot about daily life has changed in the pandemic. Remember early on when people who could afford to were panic buying and stocking up on all sorts of things? Meat prices were erratic and there were concerns about the food supply chain. We talked to people in the meat industry back then. And now, from Boise, Idaho, the Mountain West News Bureau's Madeline Beck checks back in to see how things have been going.
That's audio from a livestock auction in Idaho towards the beginning of the pandemic. It put safety precautions in place, like limiting who could come, but it stayed open. Chelsea Good is with the Livestock Marketing Association, and she said auctions like this one were crucial for meat to keep moving. Here she is in March.
We've worked with both our federal officials, but then also our states and local communities to help get them that critical food supply designation and allow them to continue operating in this important time.
Over the last months, disruptions weren't as bad as they could have been, but Good says some consumer practices have changed. People are buying what's easiest to cook themselves.
Ground beef, hamburger, to some degree roast, things people know how to prepare at home and are, you know, pretty comfortable with.
Consumers aren't buying as much of the higher-end cuts of beef. Restaurants aren't buying as many of those cuts anymore either. And getting that meat to the store is still a bit of an issue, especially for those nicer local cuts. The problem is processing the meat. When COVID-19 infected workers and slowed major packing plants, some ranchers turned to the smaller butchering facilities. And now those are backed up, too. Good says it's even hard for hunters to find places to process deer.
They called their local meat lockers and got quite a surprise in terms of the wait time. You know, at this point, it's well into 2021. I've heard of some that are backed up well into even 2022.
And more ranchers have been using those local butchers, too.
I think that it's way different right now.
Lorianne Lau is a rancher. She's been selling direct to consumer around Idaho and Utah for 16 years. But when she called her butcher back in May, he was already booked clear through April 2021.
we've just been following up with him trying to say, you know, if you can sneak any in, we'd sure love to. And he's like, you and everybody and their uncle.
Blau says her sales have picked up during the pandemic because people were concerned about the meat supply chain. They wanted to buy directly from ranchers, and she's hoping that practice gets easier for all ranchers in the years to come. Federal requirements to butcher cattle are easier for larger operations to meet. But ranchers who work with those large processors and sell their cows on the market are having troubles too.
I've heard a lot of issues with people not being particularly happy with the prices that they're being offered.
Eric Belasco is an agriculture economist at Montana State University. When we talked to him in March, he was concerned about what would happen if workers at packing plants got COVID-19.
Especially some of the larger packing plants, if they were to shut down, you'd see a remarkable impact on the market for beef.
Of course, workers did get sick at the plants. The Investigative Journalism Food and Environment Reporting Network reports more than 50,000 meatpacking workers got COVID-19, and more than 250 workers have died. And the Department of Justice is investigating the major meat companies that control the beef processing market for price fixing during the pandemic. Belasco points out that prices are less volatile now than they were back in April. That will allow farmers to budget for next year. And he says this whole ordeal shows how resilient the meat processing system is.
You had a demand shock and a supply shock, kind of like which we've never seen before. And there were some slowdowns, but by and large, you know, it kept delivering food to market.
But of course, some argue it could have been even more resilient had there been more decentralized packing plants. In Boise, Idaho, I'm Madeline Beck for Marketplace.
Coming up,
sometimes gelato would arrive completely melted.
There's a learning curve to gelato delivery. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 68 points, 0.2%, to close at 30,335. The NASDAQ slipped 49 points, 0.3%, to finish at 12,850. And the S&P 500 dropped 8 points, 0.2%, to end at 3727. Boeing picked up less than 0.1% after the flight of a Boeing 737 MAX today, the first commercial use of the plane in the U.S. since the fleet was grounded in 2019. Checking in on vaccines, the CDC says more than 2.1 million doses have been administered in the U.S., more than any other country, but fewer than hoped for at this point. The yield on the 10-year T-note ended flat at 0.93%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kimberly Adams. 2020 is almost over. And while this can be a time for celebration, let's be honest. This year, that's hard for a lot of us. Megan Devine is a psychotherapist and specializes in talking about grief. I spoke to her back in July about how we can apply the language of grief to what we're going through in this economy. And since that change and loss is still happening, economic and otherwise, I figured I'd check in with her again. Megan, thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
So when I talked to you back in July, you suggested that we need to acknowledge the grief and the loss that we're all experiencing before we can begin to move forward. It's been almost 6 months since then. Do you think that acknowledgement has happened?
I think it's happening. I don't think we've embraced it yet because it's still really new. What I see happening is not so much that because we've had so much experience over the last 7 and 8 months that we've gotten better at grief, but we've definitely got more comfortable with saying that it hurts. With so many people grieving so many different things, I think we're starting to see a backlash against those sort of empty platitudes. And what comes up in the wake of that is that acknowledgement, like, yeah, this is really hard.
I think for a lot of us, when we see these weekly unemployment numbers, or even the COVID death counts, those numbers don't really quite hit us with as much force as they used to, say, in the spring. How
how can someone absorb all of that?
I think that's a really great question, the way that you phrase that. How do we absorb all of that? We don't. We do that to protect ourselves. It's not good, not bad. It's a way of psychologically distancing ourselves from something that is too big to let in. And that makes perfect sense to me if you think the alternative is, just as you said, like, I have to take all of this in and absorb it and hold on to it and let it destroy me. Honestly, if those are our only two options, we're going to choose the emotional callus, the distance, right? So I think a conversation here to have is about how do we let that flow through us without sort of pooling up in our bodies and our minds. I don't necessarily have an answer to that, but I think that's a good question to explore.
When we spoke before, you mentioned that we have sort of this culture in America of trying to make the best of a bad situation and getting people to cheer up and feel better. And you cautioned against that in sort of trying to find a way to make what we're going through some kind of opportunity. Looking at that word in particular, I've heard a lot of this in the stories we've been covering over the last few months, where the opportunities are, how businesses are pivoting or thinking differently. What do you make of that?
I have a really hard time with the pairing of the words crisis and opportunity. And I'm not saying that there isn't opportunity. There is opportunity, but when we stitch required opportunity into a crisis, and this is sort of what we're talking about, right? Like, the second something is difficult, we're supposed to look for the gift inside of it. And all that really does is erase the very human pain that's at the core. This is related really to resilience porn, right? Where we really hold up these stories of people who triumph against all odds instead of looking at the systems that create the injustices or the situations for which they need to be resilient.
This pandemic has disproportionately affected communities of color, low-income communities. We talk a lot on the show about the K-shaped recovery. And so people are feeling the weight and the impact of this pandemic in very, very different ways. How is that affecting the way we're grieving as a community?
Yeah. You can't really do these deep emotional things if your housing is unstable, if you are having to work three jobs just to be able to feed your kids. Like, there is almost, and I really hesitate to say this, but there's almost a luxury to grieving. I hesitate to say that because grief is not a luxury, right? So it's interesting and I think complicated to look at who's allowed to grieve and who has the infrastructure and the backing behind them that they can actually feel the weight of what's happened to them. And it's, unfortunately, those things are coupled, right? The disproportionate effects of the pandemic and job loss and all of these things on communities of color, those are also the folks who don't have the infrastructure underneath them to be able to fall apart and to feel things the way that they deserve to.
Megan Devine is a psychotherapist and an author who specializes in talking about grief. Thank you so much.
You are so welcome.
Like Megan said, there are some mental health infrastructure gaps for a lot of people, but some resources are available. Megan shared a list, which is on our website, marketplace.org. And if you or someone you know is in distress right now, the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline is 1-800-273-TALK. I want to go back to something Megan and I just discussed, how stitching that need to find opportunity into a crisis can erase some of the pain and challenges people are facing. It's a point that's especially relevant when we look at how small businesses are experiencing this crisis. Sure, some of them might be pivoting, but it's not easy. Uli Nasibova owns Gelateria Uli, which has two locations in Los Angeles, and she's someone we've been catching up with time to time as her business business takes in this new economy and tries to figure out the best way to survive and to move forward.
Earlier in the pandemic, we got the PPP, as well as the Economic Injury Disaster Loan, which saved my business. The PPP loan was easy. We spent that on rent and payroll. That money evaporated in just 2 months. The EIDL loan was heftier. It is a loan. It's not forgivable. I'm still spending from it. I probably have another 7 to 9 months of being able to cover my shortfall. You can throw as many loans at me as you can. They're not going to fix the underlying problem, which is that the business environment has completely changed. It's a different world now. So the first step of our pivot was to offer a subscription model. So here I am thinking, why wouldn't somebody want a box of 4 to 5 brand new flavors every month, right? A lot of our customers, subscription customers, would get back to us and say, you know what? I like the idea, but I just want the pistachio. Can I substitute the 4 exciting flavors for just 4 pints of pistachio? So as a result, I am actually pausing the subscription model a little bit because what I want to do with my next phase is give people an option to build their own box. Sometimes I think to myself and say, why did you have to pick a product that is not only so difficult to make, but so difficult to ship? Like, couldn't have you made granola bars or something? Obviously, there were mistakes along the way. Sometimes gelato would arrive completely melted or dry ice because it's such a powerful chemical compound can actually explode. Dry ice is considered a hazardous material by UPS, FedEx, and all delivery companies. If you leave dry ice, it will turn into gas. By the way, something that I learned the hard way, never ever leave dry ice for several hours in your car, because it will suck all the oxygen out of the cabin. But let me tell you, I'm never ever making that mistake ever again. It's one of those things you learn once.
That was Uli Nasibova with a good lesson there out in LA. Tell us about your economy online at marketplace.org/myeconomy. This final note on the way out today, a public service announcement courtesy of MarketWatch, which is different from Marketplace, FYI. Those relief payments Mitchell was talking about at the top of the show will not be counted as taxable income. But if you've been getting unemployment benefits this year, you do owe the IRS on that income. Your moment of economic context on this Tuesday, I'll channel Kai here for a minute and take a look at air travel in the pandemic. Holiday edition. The Transportation Security Administration said it screened 1.28 million people on Sunday, the most airline travelers in a day since the start of the pandemic. Now, remember how all that Thanksgiving travel contributed to the surge in cases and deaths we're seeing right now? Yeah, so all that travel for Christmas has health officials saying January could be worse. Our digital and on-demand team includes Ufuk Memetolu, Olga Oxman, Erica Phillips, Brian Ronahan, and Tony Wagner. Sitara Nieves is our executive director of On Demand, and I'm Kimberly Adams. We'll see you tomorrow, everyone. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.